yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today, a couple important topics we want to address. One is this Supreme Court decision limiting workers' rights to act collectively and what it portends in terms of the attack on workers, wages, unions, and income inequality. The latest decision limiting rights of workers by the courts and their unions, and great implications here. This is very significant, and we're going to talk about that decision a little bit. I also want to talk about the Trump China trade, and how is that related to the scuttling here of the meeting with North Korea, the summit that was scheduled for June 12th to do something about the difference between Korea, North Korea, and U.S. and nuclear arms and so forth. We want to talk about that. How is the China trade deal linked to this Korea geopolitical negotiation, and how is the collapse of the political situation, the negotiations with North Korea, which was just announced yesterday by Trump, both pulling out of the meeting, both U.S. and Korea, North Korea, how is that related to what appears to be a cooling off of the love fest that was beginning between the U.S. and China on reaching a trade deal? How are the two linked? We want to talk about that. Want to say something about the Congressional Budget Office recent estimate of the Trump tax cuts' impact on budgets and deficits. We've been talking about that a little bit. Some new data coming out worth looking at. And then, of course, an update, if we have time, on what's happening with Argentina and Turkey and emerging markets crisis, currency crisis, and imminent deeper recessions in those countries. Okay, let's start with stock buybacks, however. We've been talking about the stock buybacks linked to the Trump $5 trillion corporate business tax cuts here repeatedly on this show. Once again, for those who haven't tuned in to previous shows, it's a five Trump tax cuts passed in January. It's a $5 trillion cut for businesses, corporate and non-corporate, with a $2 trillion increase in taxes on middle class and consumers, which really takes effect next year. They very cleverly put off the impact of that here before the midterm elections this November. So households, middle-class households, really began feeling the pressure from the tax hikes, eliminating exemptions and deductions and so forth, $2 trillion worth next year. So it's $5 trillion for companies and businesses and $2 trillion offsetting hikes for the rest, which is really a $3 trillion net hit to the U.S. budget deficit. But Trump is making all kinds of absurd assumptions about 3 to 4% economic growth for each of the next 10 years, which is absolutely ridiculous. We're at the end of the business cycle here. We'll talk about that. And we're going to see a recession, and I think within the next couple of years, certainly in 2019, before the end, as I'm predicting. And, of course, that will blow the Trump congressional assumptions about 3 to 4% growth, which wouldn't have happened anyway, even if there weren't a recession. Anyway, to sum up, Trump and Congress and Republicans come up with only a $1.5 trillion, sometimes a $1.3 trillion deficit total impact of the $5 trillion tax cuts because of absurd assumptions about economic growth. Well, Congressional Budget Office came out with data, with its estimate here this past week, and the Congressional Budget Office itself estimates it's a $9.5 trillion deficit added to the debt, the national debt, which is $21 trillion already, a $9.5 trillion deficit over the next 10 years. Trump and Congress had estimated a $7 trillion with their phony assumptions. I estimate, and so do some bank research, I think it's Morgan Stanley or Chase estimated $1.2 trillion deficit this coming year. That's about what I estimate, $1.2 trillion, and $12.4 trillion over the decade. So we'll end up by 2028 with a $33 to $34 trillion government debt. And that's not counting if we have a recession, by the way. Okay, so that's the Trump tax cut summary we've talked about here before. But when we talked about the Trump tax cuts, my argument was that, look, as in the past with tax cuts under George Bush, the massive amount of this tax cut is going not to stimulate economic growth in the U.S., real investment, creating jobs, but it's going to go as in the past, in the form of stock buybacks by corporations to boost their stock prices and reward their CEOs, whose compensation is largely dependent upon stock price and performance and shareholder values and so forth. And it will go into an increase in dividend payouts to shareholders, so stock buybacks and dividend payouts, and it will result in additionally, in corporate mergers and acquisitions. They'll spend it on buying up their competitors, as well as stock buybacks and dividend payouts. That's the three major areas that this is going to go, this $5 trillion tax cut, because that's where it's gone in the past under George W. Bush and Obama, who extended the Bush tax cuts, by the way. What's the record show so far? You know, we've got a quarter, first quarter of, and now we're well into the second quarter. What's the impact on stock buybacks and dividend payouts and M&A, mergers and acquisitions, of all this? Well, here's some data. Get your pencil out, all right? Data for first quarter stock buybacks for the S&P 500. This is from Dow Jones, reported last week on May 21st. $178 billion just in stock buybacks in the first quarter of this year. $178 billion, which is a 42% increase over the first quarter of 2017. Compared to 2017, the most ever a record in stock buybacks. But that's just for the S&P 500, by the way. There's more corporations than just 500 in the U.S. The $178 billion averages roughly out to $2 billion a day. $2 billion a day. Well, the most recent data I've seen for the second quarter here is that buybacks are running at a $6.1 billion per day. So the S&P 500 may be buying back stocks at $2 billion a day, but U.S. corporations in general are buying back at three times that, $6 billion a day. $6 billion a day. The $178 billion is a record, by the way, greater than even the prior record, which was reached in the third quarter of 2007, right before the crash. Okay. So we're looking at, in terms of stock buybacks, somewhere around $700 billion this year. And, you know, that's not even assuming that we're going to get an acceleration, which we're beginning to see here in the second quarter in terms of stock buybacks. So $714 billion, if you just extrapolate those numbers from the first quarter, for the S&P 500 alone. Goldman Sachs, by the way, had estimated it would be $650 billion for the year. They're a little low. Check that out at Barron's. May 12th, the report by Barron's, $650 billion. Well, I'm saying it's over $700 billion in stock buybacks. Okay, what about dividends? Well, dividends in the first quarter of this year, also a record, $113 billion. 80% of U.S. corporations increased dividends. All right, $113 billion for the first quarter of 2018. Globally, by the way, it's $1.36 trillion estimate for this year, globally. Of course, we know a lot of U.S. multinational corporations have operations abroad, and they're divvying out dividends to their foreign earners abroad or foreign shareholders abroad. Right? Check this out. Janus Global Dividend Index. This is where this data comes from. Mm-hmm. All right, so just looking at the U.S., if stock buybacks are $714 billion estimate for this year, dividends are going to be about $460 billion for this year. That's a total of $1.17 trillion just in stock and dividend payouts and buybacks for the U.S. Fortune 500 companies only. $1.17 trillion this year, U.S. only. Well, that's about $1.2 trillion. That's about what I had estimated and was talking about in some previous shows here. Okay. It could be. Obviously, if you take all U.S. corporations and all their buybacks and all their dividend payouts, you know, the 1.17 is only for the Fortune 500 companies. But if you looked at the whole picture for the U.S., there could easily be $2 to $3 trillion or even more of combined stock dividend paybacks and buyouts this year. $2 to $3 trillion, a massive amount of redistributing the tax cuts from Trump to shareholders. That's what this is all about. And boosting their stocks as they reach the conclusion of the stock market cycle here, which we're reaching. Now, if you think that's a lot of this Trump money is also going by corporations to buy each other up. We call that mergers and acquisitions, M&A activity. A lot of it's being used for that. That's what it was used for significantly as well under George W. Bush when we went through this big deal, corporate tax cuts in 2002 to 2005 under Bush, M&A activity. Well, how much M&A activity are we witnessing? In terms of a surge in M&A spending this year compared to last. Well, look at the Dealogic research source here, and you'll see that we've got a 60% increase in M&A spending over last year, 2017 first quarter. $840 billion will be spent by U.S. corporations this year and buying each other up. $840 billion, $1.96 trillion worldwide, but $840 billion in the U.S. Okay, so let's just take the Fortune 500 stock and dividend number of 1.17 right? And you add billion, trillion, and you add to it another 840 billion in mergers and acquisitions. What do you got? You got $2 trillion of spending by the Fortune 500 companies in the US on non-productive, non-investment job creating activity. 2 trillion plus. That's what the Trump tax cuts have been producing. 2 trillion plus. Let's take that 840 billion by US corporations of merger and acquisition spending. 660 billion of that is onshore, and 180 billion of that is being spent by US corporations on offshore acquisitions. That compares, 180 billion compares to the same quarter last year of 90 billion and 70 billion in 2007. US corporations are investing abroad and doubling what they did prior to this Trump tax cuts. So they're driving up their stock prices with buybacks. They're paying out record amounts to their shareholders, who then pump a lot of it back into the stock and other financial assets. And they're buying up their corporate competition. Now, when you buy up your corporate competition, right, it drives up the stock price as well, usually for the company that's being acquired. All this means we are witnessing a cyclical peak in financial markets, because historically, merger and acquisition bubbles have always appeared at the end of the business cycle. And that's what we got now. We're reaching the end of the business cycle. We're witnessing central banks like the Fed raising interest rates. We're witnessing a slowing down on global economic growth. We're witnessing a trade war or so of sorts, maneuvering by the big capitalist economies and regions here, trying to get a better protecting their share of global growth by trying to steal trade and exports from each other, right? Which causes currency instability, which we're witnessing now, especially in emerging markets. We have speculators driving up commodity prices. That's another indicator of the end of a cycle. Remember, the big oil and commodity boom occurred in the first half of 2008, right before the crash at that time. And now we're witnessing the same thing going on. And we see the yield curve flattening. All these are indicators that we're at the end of the cycle here. And this thing can pop pretty quick at any time. And I'm predicting, of course, and have been on this show, that if the Fed raises rates another three, one half to three quarters of 1% on the 10-year Treasury bond yield, which is at about three. In other words, if the Fed gets three more rate hikes, we're going to see the thing pop. They cannot raise the 10-year T-bond yield at up to 4%. It'll correct, and we'll get a big credit crunch at that particular point. By the way, in 2007, they raised it to 5.25 before it cracked. As I've been saying, because of the greater level of debt and other problems in the U.S. economy as a result of a very slow recovery, the Fed doesn't need to. The Fed can't raise rates to 5.25%. It'll pop before that. Okay. All this Trump tax cut has meant the huge corporate profits, and that's why they got the stock buybacks and the dividend payouts and the mergers and acquisitions. Just in the first quarter alone, just to take a quick look at some corporate profits here, U.S. bank corporate profits have more than doubled from $25 billion net income in the fourth quarter of last year. In one quarter, it's jumped to $58 billion in the first quarter of this year. From 25 to 58 billion. Well, in just one quarter, the banks have raked in $33 billion in one quarter? And that's why bank mergers and acquisitions are surging now, incredibly. And of course, Congress made it even easier for the acquisitions to occur, particularly at the mid-level tier of banks, by deregulating them further. U.S. corporate profits in general are up 25% in the first quarter of 2018. 25%. Banks, of course, over 100%. And the buybacks are going to continue. Well, just look at Apple. Apple last year bought back $33 billion of its stock. This year, it plans $80 billion in stock buybacks. $80 billion. Okay, so, you know, we got over $2 trillion in wasted investment that won't produce anything. 1.17 in buybacks and dividends, and another $840 billion in mergers and acquisitions. That's over $2 trillion. That's not going into anything that creates real jobs, real investment, production of real things, and raises consumer incomes and therefore consumer spending, which is 70% of the economy. Well, no wonder wages aren't rising. It's not going into real investment. And even if it does there, corporations, because the unions have been virtually destroyed, don't need to raise wages. Even though they've got all these profits, you know, they're sitting on them. No one's forcing them to. You think just because you give them more money, they're going to pass it on in wages? No. And they haven't. And they won't. What we're going to get is rising prices. Here, oil prices and commodity prices and prices of health insurance and education and everything else that's going to limit consumer spending even more than it has been to date. And that's why we're going to see a continued slowdown of the economy here. Okay. The consequence of these tax cuts, of course, and these massive redistribution of them and income to shareholders and the wealthy 1% all over again, is going to be even more income inequality, even more than we have had and are having here for the last decade. Well, actually, even before that, you know, since 2000, and you can even argue under Reagan, we had that problem as well. Okay. Another consequence is not just income inequality of all these redistribution to the wealthy 1% shareholders and corporations. Another consequence is, as I've said, this huge deficit that's coming, which is forcing the Federal Reserve, the central bank, to raise interest rates. Even though I've said they can't raise it without precipitating a crash, credit crunch, they're in... they're trying to walk the tight wire. The Fed, the central banks are trying to walk a tight wire. They know they can't raise rates as high as they once did to pay to finance this great deficit. They know they can't do that, but they're trying to raise rates to some extent because they have to finance the deficit, the same deficit. It's a big contradiction, you see. Monetary policy is locked into this fundamental contradiction. It can't raise rates without precipitating, not causing, but precipitating a crash and crunch in credit. They're limited. And as I said, that limit is probably no more than 4% on a 10-year treasury bond, probably 3.75. And we're at 3% now, 3.1 now. All right. They can't raise rates any higher than that, but they have to raise rates in order to solicit people buying U.S. Treasury bonds to fund this trillion dollar a year plus deficit every year. So they're walking a tightrope, right? Okay, so maybe the higher rates will entice foreign investors to buy treasury bonds, right? Not just U.S. investors. You know, about almost half of the purchase of treasury bonds now come from foreign investors, foreign bankers and rich folks and corporations and individuals and central banks and so forth. We are increasingly dependent on foreign purchase of our treasury bonds over the years, and now almost half. Right? Well, you know, if you keep precipitating trade wars with these folks and sticking it to them on trade and raising U.S. interest rates, which raises the value of the dollar and also raises oil prices, you're crashing their economies, and that's happening in emerging markets, and lowering their income. Well, are they going to move their money when they have less of it? And when you are reducing it for them to buy U.S. Treasury bonds, I mean, especially with China, you know, you provoke a trade war with China. Well, China can just stop buying Treasury bonds from you or slow down the purchase of U.S. Treasury bonds. And if you don't treat Japan similarly, you know, they're going to stop buying. And it, both of them buy most of Japan and China and some extent Europe buy most of the U.S. Treasury bonds now. So if you're running a $1 trillion deficit a year and you're raising rates and half of the people who buy the Treasury bonds that you're trying to get them to purchase because of higher rates, you're sticking it to them in other ways, with currency wars and trade wars, well, then maybe they won't buy as much. Well, what are you going to do then? $1 trillion deficits. Can you finance? Well, maybe the Fed has to raise rates even more than its 3% federal funds rate, which is coming in another week, right? Okay, but then we're faced with that ceiling contradiction of 3.75 or 4% at the max. So the Fed, the Federal Reserve, the central bank's scope of maneuvering here is very, very limited. And of course, if you raise rates, you're going to slow down the U.S. economy as well. Already, new homes and existing home purchases and activity is slowing rapidly. We've just about on the cusp of shutting down the housing market. And of course, we see auto rates now of 4.5-5% or more to borrow a loan, at least 5%. You know, unless you got great credit, you might get 4.5% on an auto loan. Well, that's going to shut down the auto market in the U.S. as well. Well, maybe that's why Trump is trying to help the auto companies by imposing tariffs on other foreign imports here. You know, boost the U.S. auto companies here to some extent. So we got a housing and auto freeze up. If we keep raising rates, it's already happening. But we may precipitate another problem here, and that is we may set off a retail junk bond bubble crash. If rates rise further, retail companies, you know, like Penny's and Sears and everything, are up to their elbows in junk bond borrowing that they've been rolling over to stay in business. And if you raise the rates much higher in junk bonds, well, then they won't be able to borrow. At some point, the banks are going to say, "I'm sorry, Sears, you're not a good risk. We're not going to loan you anymore." And there goes Sears into the dustbin, economic dustbin of history. And that's coming. Well, this is similar to what happened in 1985-87 when we had a bubble in commercial retail, and that bubble bust, junk bond bubble bust, and crashed retail. And that was related, of course, to the 1987 stock market crash, which people don't quite understand that we're seeing similar conditions. You know, what we're seeing emerging now is a condition similar to that, and a condition similar in the stock bubble to the 2000 bubble, 2000 tech bubble, right? Not tech, but stocks in general here. So far, this is not a 2008-9 financial crash cycle, but it's looking like it has similarities to 2000-2001. And if we precipitate a crisis by raising rates in the value of the dollar in emerging markets, it's going to look something like the Asian credit crunch. So it looks like you know, what happened in the past is ripening here once again, similar to the 1990s, early 2000s, rather than 2008, because the rising interest rates by the Fed to fund the deficit is causing the dollar to rise. And of course, the dollar is linked to oil prices because oil speculation is done in dollars. So that's what's helping drive up the price, the commodity price, and the price of oil, because oil on the futures market is a currency. You see, it's a speculation. Oil prices are not due to long term supply or demand. Short term fluctuations in oil prices, as I pointed out in my book 2016, Systemic Fragility in a Global Economy, are really caused by dollar movements, which are caused by interest rate movements. All right. So if the dollar keeps rising, as we've said in the past, I'm not going to repeat it a lot here, that precipitates a crisis in emerging market economies because their currency declines in relation to the dollar as the dollar rises. If their currency declines, investors, both foreign and domestic, in those countries like Argentina, for example, the worst case right now, take their money out of Argentina. They sell their pesos, Argentine pesos, for dollars, which drives up the price of the dollar further and drives down the price of the peso even further. But they want to get out of that currency because it's collapsing in value, and that means they're losing paper profits, and they want to get into the currency that's rising. So they convert, the consequence, the response of the Argentine government and central banks is to raise their interest rates domestically in order to entice, instead of capital flight out of the country, entice them to invest in bonds or interest-bearing securities in Argentina. Right now, Argentine central bank rate, interest rate is 40% to try to stem the collapse of their currency, but it's collapsing anyway. And of course, if you have a collapse of your currency and you import a lot of goods and services from abroad, which these smaller countries do, that means you got import inflation, and that means you got rising prices and rising interest rates, which stifle the domestic economy. So you got stagflation. You got a recession with accelerating inflation. And that's the crisis in Argentina and Turkey now. Seems to be the worst case is now shifting to Turkey and the Turkish lira currency. So watch Argentina and watch Turkey as a bellwether, canaries in the coal mine of the emerging market economies. All of that, of course, is a consequence of rising interest rates in the U.S. And rising dollar in the U.S., which is a consequence of the huge deficits we've got, which is a consequence, in turn, of the massive tax cuts that Trump has passed. But, of course, those who are shareholders, they're doing wonderful. What we're doing is transferring income not only from U.S. consumers and workers and households to the wealthiest 1% shareholders and their corporations, but where those shareholders and corporations are now undertaking policies that transfer income from emerging markets back to them. Both are going on. Massive. Well, Why are they doing this? Because growth is slowing and the possibility of profits from actually earning them is being shifted in 21st century U.S. global capitalism from earning your profits to simply financial manipulations as the means for profit growth, you see, financial profits. Well, I talked about that in great detail in my Systemic Fragility and Global Economy book, which you can get a free summary, concluding chapter, on my blog, jackrasmus.com, or you can go to the website, my website from the blog, and read it there. That was the fundamental thesis I had in that particular book, and I did a survey in the first part of that book, empirical survey of the major economic sectors of the global economy. There's chapters on China, there's chapters on Europe, on Japan, on emerging markets, on global commodity oil prices, and on fiscal policies and monetary policies, and this whole financial investing shift, which is ongoing. Fundamental change, 21st century capitalism, is this thing about the shift to financial profits. And of course, we see the consequences in the last 10 years, where the Federal Reserve kept interest rates at virtually zero, and that boosted the stock market and the bond markets. You know, they reaped in over $1 trillion every year from stock and bond profits. U.S. investors and corporations did. The Fed, in bailing out the banks, subsidized the U.S. corporate elite in general for 8 years. You know, well, 7 years. No, 8 years, 2016. 8 years. They subsidized them. The central bank has played a role of subsidization, not just bailing out the banks, which it did in 2008-9. By 2010, the banks were already bailed out. But it kept doing that for another 6 years. Didn't have to. Well, from a bailout function, lender of last resort, they call it, the central bank evolved into a subsidization of capital incomes function. That's the nature of 21st century capitalism, where the financials, the state is subsidizing them. Okay, when the Fed started backing off of that in 2017, raising rates, what the corporate and business and political elites in this country did was to shift from monetary policy to subsidize to fiscal policy, the Trump tax cuts. When the Fed finally gave up subsidizing and raising rates, 2017, we got a shift to fiscal policy subsidization at $5 trillion. You see, the state in the 21st century plays an increasing role in subsidizing capital incomes more than ever before. Well, is that because the capitalists can't make profits the way they used to, or whether they just found a way to make even more profits than before? I don't know which is which here. Do they want more because they just want more, or do they are they shifting to financial profits and state subsidization simply because they can't sustain normal growth and profitability from normal real investment? You go figure, right? Which one? It's hard to tell. Maybe it's both. Right, depends on the sector. Certainly, the tech sector is growing, and they're growing their profits from real investment and financial investment. Of course, you know, Apple $100 billion planned stock buyback program. You know, that's financial asset. Well, these multinational corporations are really banks. You know, a third of all their profits come from what's called portfolio investment. Portfolio investment is just financial investment, financial speculation. That's all it is. Okay, so that's the update on the continuing income shift as a result of stock buybacks and mergers and acquisitions and dividend payouts, the latest data for the first quarter. Right now, we got data to see that it's accelerating even faster than it was in 2017. Let's turn to those folks who are on the short end of all this. We're talking about regular households, consumers, workers, who aren't getting wage increases because we're not getting real investment, you see, that's why, and because we've destroyed the unions, that's why, and because we won't raise minimum wages federally, that's why, and a lot of other reasons why wages aren't rising. Also because employers don't feel they have to. No one's pushing them, so they're not going to. Lots of reasons, but mostly destruction of unions and wage law compression and atrophy of minimum wages and so forth. And also because of other factors here, distribution factors. And of course, when wages don't rise and you've got the financial driven profits and speculation accelerating the incomes, the capital income side, you get inequality, income inequality due to two forces. One, growing the capital incomes at an increasing accelerating rate while you stagnate or worse, reduce wage incomes, earned incomes. Both of them drive income inequality. You know, liberals and so forth, they focus just on the fact there's no wage increases, and that's true. You know, perhaps even more so, the income inequality is driven by these obscene accelerating capital incomes subsidized by the state and by financial speculation. All right, let's turn to those who are on the short end of that stick. And the Supreme Court decision of this past week, Epic Systems Corp versus Lewis. What is this about? Well, it's about corporations and management being able to force arbitration on workers to prevent collective action over workplace disputes. Oftentimes, these workplace disputes by workers have to do with the failure to pay wages or wage theft or other ways that corporations and management simply shortchange workers for wages they were supposed to get. So we're really talking about that part of the working class and the labor force that is most exposed to this kind of exploitation, and that's what it is. It's just super exploitation when they won't pay tips or they steal tips from workers or other ways they don't pay overtime pay or they skimp on other kinds of obligations that's required by state and local government labor codes and so forth. I'm not even talking about people in unions. I'm talking about the non-union workforce, which, by the way, in the private sector, is now 94% of the private sector, 146 million people, do not have unions. Only 6% of that 146 million are in unions in the private sector. In the public sector, it's higher. It's over 30%, but they're under direct attack as well now. But they've totally decimated and destroyed private sector unions. So, you know, private sector workers are really at risk because they have no unions. Well, they still had the right to engage in collective action, in other words, to file class action lawsuits to get their wages back that were stolen from them. All right, but this decision, this Epic Rescission Corp versus Lewis decision now, which has been approved by the Supreme Court, the law of the land, allows corporations to require arbitration on individual workers to prevent collective action. So it's one-on-one, an individual worker, right, versus, Walmart or versus KFC or whatever, to get their wages back. Right? So, you know, how many of them are going to feel courageous enough, and I don't blame them, to take on them, the corporation, even by going into arbitration. You know, and what are the costs that when we go into arbitration? It's going to cost them something, right? Class action lawsuits, it usually doesn't cost someone to join the class action. The lawyers forego that to push the class action. But when you're individual in arbitration, it's going to cost you something. Oh, well, you know, forced arbitration, you can get a lawyer and go into the arbitration hearing. How many workers, you know, making $20,000, $30,000 a year, whose wages are being stolen from them, are actually going to do that? Get a lawyer and go into arbitration? Are they going to go into arbitration themselves? Yeah, well, the company attorney will be there, and he'll make mincemeat out of you. And they know that, so they don't. They won't file. They'll just put up with the wage theft or whatever. But wait a minute, this decision is not just about arbitration clauses, which, by the way, have grown in the last quarter century tremendously, from about a few percentages, 2% in 1992, according to the dissent of Supreme Court Justice Ginsburg. Forced arbitration clauses in 1992 affected 2% of corporations, but by 2018, 54% of corporations had forced arbitration clauses on their employees, 54%. And this decision is certainly going to grow that percent, right? Now, let's talk about the broader implications of this. You know, we have 25 million arbitration contracts out there now, and they're going to grow, and it's going to cut off class action, and it's going to mean workers are going to lose even more wages as a result, especially those who are most desperate and in need of these wages. They're going to lose it. But this has broader significance, you see, because what this says, and what the Supreme Court, Roberts, a corporate lawyer, now at Gorsuch, a corporate lawyer, they've got a solid 5-4 majority, just about everything, and they're going after unions and workers like never before. What this SCOTUS Supreme Court U.S. Decision means is that the decision harkens back to the 1925 Federal Arbitration Act. It uses that 1925 Act as a justification for taking away workers' rights to collectively engage in mutual aid and assistance with regard to wages and working conditions. Now, that act, that Arbitration Act, 1925 Arbitration Act, was one of the vehicles that corporations used to prevent unionization in the 1920s. And it wasn't until 1935 that another federal act called the Wagner Act, or sometimes the National Labor Relations Act, was passed, giving workers the right to engage in collective action to mutually improve their wages and working conditions, and they couldn't be discriminated against in the sense of firing them or threatening them or taking away their hours or wages or so forth, right? Section 7A of the 1935 Act gave workers the right to unionize and or engage in any kind of collective action. Now, this Forced Arbitration Act here takes away the right to engage in mutual support for each other. And it appears to only affect non-union workers, which is 94% of the labor force. But the next step will be corporations will use this precedent and this decision to limit collective bargaining for the remaining 6%, and certainly for workers attempting to unionize. They're not union yet. They're attempting to unionize. Will the government and corporations say, oh, look, you have to go through arbitration before you can have a union election? Yeah, that's the next step, you see. The next step is to apply it against a tactic, a vehicle against non-union workers attempting to organize, and then against collective bargaining itself, perhaps. You can foresee the possibility that they will be arguing, well, that particular demand is not a demand you can collectively bargain over. It's a demand that has to go to arbitration. You know, that's how they'll undermine collective bargaining for workers who have unions. They'll undermine it for workers trying to organize unions. And for the immediate 94%, they'll use it to prevent mutual class actions. You see where this is leading? Yes. Right. It will negate countless state and local government labor laws and labor code rights, right? Because federal law takes precedent over state law. It will open the door to prevent unionization by possibly requiring arbitration of disputes first. It will undermine potential collective bargaining. And it's only the latest in a long list of anti-union laws that have begun expanding in the last decade here, which, by the way, the Democrats and Obama did nothing about. What do we see most recently, particularly since Trump? We got a real anti-union offensive emerging here. One is the right to work, it's called, which is really a Koch brothers-funded state-level offensive to outlaw at the state level what's called the union shop. In other words, require workers to join a union. We already had 20-some states that have been passing this, and it existed here for decades, since 1947, right to work for less, it's called. It's a euphemism, meaning you can't force people to join a union, right? The union can organize a factory or a workplace, and by law it has to negotiate on everybody for everybody. Just because it has to negotiate for everybody, not everybody has to join and support the union, you see. And so you get maybe half of the people, and half of them being freeloaders, taking the benefits of the union contract but not paying anything for the cost of negotiating or supporting the union, etc. Okay, that's called eliminating the union shop. The union shop is if you have a union shop contract, after 30 days on the job, you got to join the union. Okay, you got to pay dues and join the union. All right, so that's one big offensive that's spreading and has been spreading to additional states in recent years. And soon we will end up probably just with the Northeast and the West Coast having the right to negotiate a union shop agreement. Now, a union shop's not the same as a closed shop, you see. A closed shop was outlawed in 1947. A closed shop means you got to go to the union hiring hall to get your job. The employer don't hire you. The union has control over who gets hired. Well, that was powerful, you see. That was a powerful thing for solidarity amongst workers, the clothes shop. Well, that was years ago, over half a century ago, outlawed, except for those unions that had it before 1947, right? But now even the union shop, right to work, is all about eliminating the union shop. But now we have also, we talked about earlier in the year, what's called the Janus decision, which prevents, even in the public sector, negotiating the ability to pay at least what's called agency fees. Okay, so you don't join the union, you don't have to join the union, but you got to pay your fair share to support the cost of collective bargaining. That's an agency shop. Well, they're attacking that legally. Let's get rid of the agency shop. That's the Janus decision, right? Let's pass right-to-work laws. That's under Taft-Hartley. And now we've got the Epic Systems Corp decision. You can't act collectively to support your mutual aid wages and conditions. What's also coming, I predict, is eliminating the dues checkoff. This is another big offensive. What's the dues checkoff? That's a provision, a clause in collective bargaining agreements where the employer will collect from the paycheck the union dues, own the union or the agency fees, and deliver them to the union. That way the union doesn't have to spend its money on representatives running around collecting dues from people on the job. You know, that's the way it was done, you know, a century ago. The union had to have people run around, say, hey, pay your dues, right? Give me a check, give me the money. You know, that doesn't work. And it's a waste of union resources. And it divides the union. And not all, you know, tremendous cost to the union to collect its own dues. Well, that's a way of weakening the unions financially, you see. Well, that's coming as well. So we have this massive attack on unions and worker rights. And this EPIC Systems decision is only the latest part of this decision. And it's a long history of using the laws against unions. You know, in the 19th century, unions were considered illegal because they conspired to combine to improve their wages, right? And you weren't supposed to engage in collusion and combining to raise prices, and a wage is just the price of labor. So the courts ruled throughout the 19th century in the U.S. That workers' unions were illegal combinations, you see. Of course, the employers could do the same, and no one enforced that, but they enforced it against the unions. If a union tried to organize workers, the employer would simply go to a court and get an injunction that the union here was violating laws on competition. Well, in the 1890 decision, the Sherman Antitrust Act, right, they solidified and formalized this. The Antitrust Act was supposed to be against the Sherman Act, against employers like Rockefeller's Standard Oil, right, setting prices, right, with other companies. And antitrust was aimed at corporations, but it wasn't applied to them. What it was applied to were workers and their unions. So the Antitrust Act in 1890 was used. Court injunctions were used to bust strikes. If you went on strike, the employer simply got a court to issue an injunction. If you didn't stop the strike, well, then they brought in the police and they arrested, first of all, your leaders, your union leaders, and they fined your union so much every day. And then if that wasn't enough, they arrested other people who weren't union officers until they busted the strike. At the same time, they used corporate Pinkerton, private police forces to violently break up unions and strikes and so forth, and the courts overlooked that. In the 1920s, they got a little more sophisticated. The courts approved what were called the American and Rockefeller plans. What these plans were to form company unions. In other words, the company would get their lawyer, their foreman, to solicit workers to join a phony union, and maybe there would be several phony unions formed, and the employer would say, well, I don't know which one represents your workers until you work this out. I'm not sitting down with you. Or if there was only one phony union, the Rockefeller plan, you would sit down and negotiate with them. So there's a long history of using the law against workers' rights and union rights, and this latest decision is only Epic Systems, the latest in a long history.